The Spectator magazine is home to wonderful writing, insightful analysis, and unrivalled books and arts reviews. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online, along with a free £20 John Lewis or Waitrose voucher. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello and welcome to Table Talk, the Spectator's food and drink podcast. I'm Olivia Potts, and today we are delighted to be joined by Daria Lavelle. Daria is a writer. Born in Kiev, she was raised in New York and has worked as a fiction writer, with her short stories being published in The Deadlands and Dread Machine. Her first book, Aftertaste, explores food, grief and the uncanny, and will be published by Bloomsbury on the 22nd of May. Daria, welcome to Table Talk.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
We're going to start where we always do, at the very beginning, and ask you, what are your earliest memories of food?
I love this question. I have so many early memories of food and eating and food rituals. Food was really an important touchstone, I think, in my house growing up. And I have all of these specific recollections of eating various things that small children did not like to eat when I was a small child. So I have all sorts of memories of eating, and I still eat them, entire lemons whole, anything sour, anything pickled, not just pickled cucumbers, but pickled tomatoes, pickled watermelon, pickled apples, all that sort of stuff comes back from, I'm Ukrainian, so it comes back from sort of that Ukrainian cultural Eastern European tradition of eating. And then I also loved olives, inexplicably. I was obsessed with
olives. That's so grown up.
So grown up. I called them salty little plums. And my parents talk all the time during immigration. So when we left Ukraine, I was 2. And we came to the U.S. and you couldn't go directly here at the time. You had to stop in Austria and Italy in our case. And when we were in Italy, I ate olives just by the fistful. My parents talk about it all the time. So I developed all of these interesting, unusual tastes. Bubbly water is another one. So sparkling water, most children won't go near. My own children like it a lot, but most kids I know refuse because it's kind of sizzly and sparkly on your tongue, and loved it. Couldn't get enough. I had all of these sort of peculiar tastes and flavors. And then I also remember loving to cook. So I'd be about 8 or 9 years old, and I would wake up before everybody else, the way children do. And to keep myself occupied until my parents, my older brother, got up, I would make breakfast. My mom at the time would buy these pre-made doughs, and I would wake up and they would be waiting for me. And I would make croissants, or I would make morning pastries and buns and all sorts of things. And I would add stuff to them. And probably ill-advised to let a small child use an oven, but nevertheless.
You survived to tell the tale.
We survived. And I just have all of these memories of cooking with my parents. They were amazing cooks. They still are. And they would do this party every year where they would make thousands of these tiny dumplings by hand called pelmeni. And they would have their friends over, and everyone looked forward to it every year. It was a winter thing. And they would just hand, I remember them in the kitchen, hand making every single one, stuffing them and then boiling them, or frying them, serving them all different ways. It was a great time.
We often ask, were mealtimes important growing up, you know, sitting down as a family, having a ritual? But I think I know what your answer is going to be there. I mean, it sounds massively important to you as a family.
Yeah. We did a lot of cooking together. We'd usually sit down, even on busy evenings. Both my parents worked, and even then we tried to sit down and have a meal. But on weekends, certainly, it would be one of those things where we'd all go to the grocery store together. When I was little, I would ride in the cart and I would get fed things along the way, so I didn't complain. And then we'd go home with whatever we bought at the grocery store, and it would be an all-day kind of cooking event. And my parents were really adventurous with what they made. My mom tended to make lots of sort of Eastern European, Ukrainian, Russian dishes growing up. And my dad started to cook later in life. So he wasn't always the go-to default chef in our family. I think he sort of has become that now, but he got interested in it because my mom was always in the kitchen. He wanted to spend time with her, and he was incredibly adventurous with all of the different things that he wanted to try. So he would just buy a cookbook from a random cuisine and choose a recipe and get excited. And so we had all sorts of, I was very spoiled growing up in terms of food. We had all sorts of like French dishes that we just decided to try to make, Korean food. My dad would make sushi by hand, all of these sorts of things that I think I probably took for granted how lucky I was that my parents were so willing to try different foods and try their own hand at making them.
And the sort of cooking that your mum was doing, the cooking that came from Ukraine and from your heritage, was that something that was easy to ape in the US at that point? I mean, I suppose if you're doing your own ferments, then you're sort of able to kind of, it feels like a hack into having kind of more traditional food. Was she having to make compromises? How did it work?
So we did a lot of doing those sorts of things at home. So we pickled a lot of our own pickles. My mom would make yogurts from home and all sorts of farmers' cheeses and still does. I think we were fortunate in that where we lived in particular. So we started out in Staten Island in New York, and then we eventually moved to New Jersey. And where we lived in New Jersey had a high Eastern European population, a lot of Russian families, Ukrainian families, and there was a Russian store. And so they actually imported a whole bunch of food that was salamis from Eastern Europe, bolognese, caviar, pickles. They made a lot of stuff by hand more traditionally there. So it wasn't too difficult to get it, but you did have to go to this one or maybe two stores to do it. Although I will say that my parents primarily, we cooked at home. We did a lot of all the preparation at home. So it was using the techniques that my grandmother and my great-grandmother sort of passed on, because in Ukraine, everything was sort of made at home anyway. So,
well, that's what I was going to ask you about, actually, because there is much more of a culture in Ukraine and those of Eastern European countries that you've mentioned of from-scratch cooking, whereas there's a bit of a fetishization of it in the US, but it's not commonplace. You know, you sort of see like the farmhouse style of doing it, but, you know, if you went to a neighbor's house, they may well not be. Were you aware at the time of how from scratch your sort of childhood eating was?
Yes, I was painfully aware. I was very acutely aware that what we ate at home was very different than what my American friends were eating. And it definitely became this source of almost discomfort and otherness for me. Like, I would be in the cafeteria and I would be eating what my parents packed me, and I would look around and no one else would be eating something similar. It would be a sea of peanut butter and jelly or Lunchables or something kind of. And I knew that I loved what I was eating, but in the moment, it felt so disorienting to be eating it. And when I would go to my friends' houses after school and their parents would make dinner, a lot of it would be, you know, let's heat up some chicken nuggets. Let's take some frozen corn and microwave it. And to me, those flavors inexplicably became delicious, even though as an adult in my mind, I'm like, that probably wasn't great. But even so, it was delicious because it was like, wow, I'm American this way. I'm eating American food. I'm assimilating. And I think as a child, that's what you want so badly, to belong and to feel like you're part of something. And so there was always this strong divide. Meanwhile, my friends would come to my house and I would be mortified when my mom would serve them, you know, handmade kotlety, or my grandmother would be there and would be serving some sort of pirozhok, like some sort of little meat pie, and my friends would devour it, and I'd be like, oh god, can we please make mac and cheese.
And after school you left for college. Were you on a meal plan there, or was that the beginning of you cooking for yourself?
So I was on a meal plan there. So I went to Princeton University. They had a very extensive meal plan. You were required to be on one, actually, for at least the first 2 years. And then in the last 2 years, you could kind of choose if you were going to cook for yourself or stay on the meal plan. I happened to be a residential advisor, so I got the meal plan anyway. But I will say, I think that food and ritual around food and eating together was very much a part of our collegiate experience. It wasn't the sort of thing where you went to the dining hall, you grabbed something and you went back to studying. You always sat and ate. In fact, you would linger at these tables for a long time in conversation. You'd have a second dinner, sometimes like a hobbit. And I remember there just being this lovely, relaxed feeling, being at the table with your peers and getting to share meals.
And what was food like in Princeton on a meal plan when you were there?
It was really not bad. It was not I would say it was better than the typical college experience that I had in my head. They had a wide variety of food, which was really nice. And the town of Princeton itself also has a really vibrant food culture. So if you got sick of what you were eating, you could go to a restaurant or you could go pick up a different sandwich or a wrap or even a slice of pizza. I will say that the food options were pretty numerous. There were lots of dining halls. Each one had its own kind of special bent, and you could eat at any one with your meal plan. So you could migrate around the campus and try different things. I did find myself gravitating towards the kinds of food where you could customize it a little bit. So making your own salad, or they had a wrap station, or they had a grill, so you could kind of get different things and mix them together. So it was sort of like cooking without cooking.
And when you were first sort of living out as a grown-up and responsible for fending for yourself, what did you choose to cook then?
At that point, there was a lot of what is easy and what is cheap. I would go to the supermarket or the grocery store, sometimes the farmer's market if I was lucky, and I would choose what was available, what kind of looked good. That was always how I was raised. We'd go and we'd look at produce stands, my parents, and we'd choose just what was in season and what looked good. So I would choose something, and then I would say I cook like I write, which is sort of by intuition. I'll open the refrigerator, see what's there. I'll go to the grocery store and see what's available. And I'll just think to myself, okay, I have an eggplant, a thing of pasta, and a can of tomatoes. How can I make this into something? And I'll kind of articulate it in my mind and just go with it. A lot of it is sort of tasting as I go, figuring out which ingredients kind of go together and which don't. And so it was a lot of experimentation. It was a lot of different pastas, I will say. There were a couple of core dishes that I still go back to that I make. I made this one cavatappi with shrimp with these breadcrumbs on top that was delicious that I still go back to. It was a lot of also things that were just really easy to put together. Tuna melts, things like that, where you would make kind of tuna fish and then make it grilled cheeses. It was an exercise more in how can I do this quickly and get back to the rest of my life at the very, very early phase. And then as I got older and was working in the city in Manhattan, there was a lot of takeout, mostly because it was just so available and so good. So I would try to eat from different places and try different cuisines as much as I could. At one point, I did subscribe, and I still subscribe actually, to one of those meal kit services where they'll just deliver a bunch of ingredients and some recipes and you get to play around and do it. I will say that I often go off-piste from the prescribed recipe and add some of my own things or remove some things I don't think work as well. But it's a really easy way, especially with small children, to get a fresh meal on the table that is homemade, that is
prescribed. And to have the bones of it ready for you.
Yes, absolutely.
How old are your children now?
I have 6-year-old twins and I have a 15-month-old baby.
And how have you found having children has changed your approach to food, if at all?
It's been a profound change because in the beginning, I found my children were really, really small when they first started trying foods. They were incredibly open, incredibly adventurous to every single flavor. You could give anything mashed.
Do you think at that point you're the best parent in the world? You've created genius foodies. What are other people complaining about? And then you come down.
And then there is the turn. And then inevitably they will try something that you cringe at. And that's what they love.
And that's so all they'll eat. Yeah.
That's all they'll eat. And so we do a lot of beige food. We do a lot of toast and a lot of cereal and a lot of oatmeal, a lot of pasta. But I also think those are things that serve as a nice basis. So we try to incorporate other ingredients on top of those and get them back to being more varied. I will say my older children are more adventurous than the baby now. They kind of went into their phase where they like what they like, but they're willing to try different ingredients. They're willing to try different cuisines. And I think that's because we would take them, even when they were really small, we would go out to eat and we would take them to restaurants and we would have them try ramen and sushi and, you know, schnitzel and all sorts of things that we didn't necessarily always make at home, just so they could have those flavor profiles and have them be familiar. I heard somewhere that a child has to try something like 35 or 40 times before their palate adjusts to wanting to taste it again. So we'll get there slowly, baby steps.
It's really hard. And I think that the tasting and trying thing is, it's really daunting, but it's really important. We're about to take our 3-year-old and 1-year-old to Japan. And I'm 50% completely thrilled and excited and 50% so intimidated at the thought of trying to do things, I suppose, without those safe foods, without those bases of toast and Weetabix and that kind of thing. And just, you know, thrust them into 2 weeks of novelty. But yeah, it's the right brave thing to do, but it's not easy, is it?
I think you'd be surprised. I think they will love it. I think Japan has such an amazing, vibrant food culture.
And so varied.
So varied. And I think you can find incredible things that aren't what they've eaten, but are like proxies. Like you can find incredible fruit in season and different varieties.
Yes.
So there will be great options for them. I wouldn't worry.
So tell us about leaving university. How do you get from leaving university to your debut novel? Because there's a little bit in between. Tell us about that.
There's a lot of bit in between. So I did study comparative literature and creative writing. And when I graduated, I knew that I wanted to be a writer. That was always my dream since I was 15. I knew that was my goal, what I wanted. I worked towards it. I wrote a ton. I wrote short stories. I wrote novels. And I had attempted various times to get different manuscripts published. I had been agented. I had gone out to publishers. And everything was sort of a no. It would feel really hopeful on submission. And then I would get rejected and I'd start out from scratch again. And to support myself, I wound up going into marketing and advertising. So I worked in advertising for about 10 years and I kept writing. So I would be that stereotypical writer after, you know, a long work day. I would arrive at a cafe at 7 or 8 p.m. with my little laptop and I would sit there until the doors closed. And I would type away and I would dream up all of these stories and all of these big ideas. And so I tried to sell 3 novels that way. They were in the YA space, so very different than what Aftertaste wound up being. And I kept taking different classes to try to improve my craft. I have this incredible writer's workshop that we've been together since we graduated college. We went to college together. And they were incredibly inspiring. And my husband was incredibly supportive. He kept saying, this is the thing that you love and you want to do it. Keep going. A no is a no, but you know, put that aside and keep going. And so I did. I was incredibly stubborn. A lot of sane people would probably have given up, but I am not one of those people. And at one point in 2013, I was at my desk and I had this idea. It was this image of a chef plating a beautiful meal in a really ugly apartment and this ghost coming through the wall to eat the meal. And I knew instantly as soon as that idea came into my head, it sort of arrived like this one little seed, like this ingredient of this bigger thing. And I knew that it was really special. I immediately gravitated towards it. And I was like, this is a big idea. This is something. But I didn't know what it was. And I decided that I had to let it percolate and let it simmer. And I tried to write into it a few different ways, but I knew that I didn't have the story yet. I didn't have the thing. And I let it sit. I worked on different things, but over the years I would have these moments where I would furiously take a note and I would be inspired by something. I would say, this is for this story. This is part of this journey. And there were all of these instances. I was at a bar with my husband. We were waiting to go see a play and I looked up and the bar was called the Library of Spirits, which winds up being one of the scenes that ended up in Aftertaste. And I had this moment, I was like, I can't speak to you. I just need to write this down. And for 15 minutes, I sat there with my little notes app and I was like, okay, this happens, then this happens. And there were those moments along the way, these little breadcrumbs. And finally in 2017 or 2018, I decided that I was going to reapply for MFA programs. I had applied right when I graduated college. It didn't wind up working out, but I said, I'm going to apply again. This is really what I want to do. And I want to give myself this chance and this try. So I reapplied. I got in this time. And when I arrived on campus in 2019 into 2020, this was the novel that I started writing as part of that program. I knew that I wanted it to be my thesis. I knew that I wanted to try and finish it during the course of the program. And then, of course, the pandemic happened and we were all relegated to doing everything from home. But I think in large part, being able to work on Aftertaste was my way of escaping that. So I had, my twins were, I think, 2 at the time and even 1.5. And we were home all together. And I would write this novel late at night. And it was my way of escaping into the restaurants that I loved in Manhattan, of going to visit all of those places and eat those foods that I couldn't eat because everything was shut down. Talk about making things from scratch. And so that kind of became the early parts of the experience of writing Aftertaste. And then when the world opened back up, I was able to finish the manuscript. It became my thesis. I met my agent during one of the meet and greets through my university from the MFA program. And she loved the first 10 pages. And then we sort of chatted on and off for, I think, close to 8 or 9 months until I finished the full manuscript. I still remember I had spoken to her in May. And I said, yeah, I'm working on it. It's going to be done, but I don't know when, maybe September. September 1st, I got an email from her in my inbox saying, I've just finished watching The Bear. Are you done with your manuscript? I can't stop thinking about it. So it was a very kind of bolstering, exciting amount of enthusiasm about it. And when I finally did finish the manuscript, I still had all of these nervous feelings about going out with it because I had been through this process a couple of times and I had gotten rejections. And so I was very realistic. I was saying to myself, okay, this is all great and we're all very excited, but this might turn into nothing. And you've been down this road before and start thinking of the next idea. And I remember the big moment when it happened. We had sent out the manuscript. It had been, I think, 48 hours at that point or 72 hours, like 2 or 3 days, not long. But I already started to say to myself, I was like, just let it go. This might not be the one. And I was laying in bed and I was searching for baby clothes because I was pregnant with my 15-month-old. I was about 7 months pregnant. And I got this text message from my agent saying, are you awake? And I was like, I'm awake now. And it turned out that Alexis, my amazing editor from Bloomsbury, had read the book basically overnight. She stayed up all night reading it. It was like 4 in the morning, I think, in UK time. And she loved it and she wanted to acquire it. And that was one of those moments when my life completely changed.
So food in Aftertaste, for those who are listening but haven't read it, food is pivotal. It's a real plot point. Your protagonist is able to use cooking as a means of summoning people who've died, essentially. And it's really important that those dishes are very precisely the food that is relevant to the dead person. So therefore, the descriptions that you give of that food are granular in their detail. It's really, really precise, really evocative. And I was interested in a couple of things when I was reading those. The first is, have you written about food in the past in other iterations in short stories or manuscripts, or did you come to it sort of newly with Aftertaste?
So food has always been an obsession of mine, but I had never written it really into my fiction, aside from, occasionally describing what somebody was eating, describing a flavor somebody remembered in a kind of Proustian Medlin sort of way. But this was the first time where I think years of reading cookbooks, of watching cooking shows, of watching my parents cook, of cooking myself and experiencing different flavors and different cuisines and being really tuned into that. I think this was when all of that sort of manifested. This was my first try at writing something that felt like eating. And there were even moments where I would try to eat the foods that I was describing to get the mouthfeel right. And I cannot tell you how many Reese's cups I consumed trying to get that exact flavor of that soft chocolate and the way it melts and it's not quite chocolate and it's got the peanut butter. So for some very specific, very familiar foods, I felt the need to go back and try them and make sure that I was getting them right. For other foods, I completely invented recipes for several of the dishes in Aftertaste that wind up being these sort of spiritual connections that can bring a spirit back. And in some cases, I would attempt to make the flavors, but in most cases, I just knew in my head what it would taste like from just experiencing cooking and experiencing flavors. And again, like all those experiments when I was younger, knowing what flavors go together or don't. And I would use that sort of intuition, also paired with what that character needed at the time. So I think one of the things in Aftertaste that happens is that the food is never just the food. The food is really evocative of a particular flavor of memory. So is it bittersweet? Is it something that really disturbs the spirit that's trying to come back? Is it something warm? Is it something that they're excited to taste again? Is it a recollection that buoys them, or is it something that crushes them? And so I think thinking about what's the mentality of the person trying to return, and how does that actually find its way into the food, into the dish? That was really important in figuring out, is this dish scorched, for example? Is it really just burnt beyond wanting to be edible? And yet this is what it has to be to bring the spirit back.
I think the precision of it feels like you have an excellent taste intuition, but also a really good sense memory, I think, for being able to compare. So it reminded me actually of reading Ruth Reichel's memoirs, where, you know, she recalls these dishes that she's had at various different restaurants. And you think, how are you able to bring back that level of detail? Do you consciously log food, you know, mentally whilst you're eating it? Or is it just all up there?
Well, first of all, it's an astounding compliment. Thank you. I will take that every day. I think I'm very, very conscious. I think it comes down to when I started to write, I started to do this thing in my head from a really young age where I narrated things I was seeing and feeling and tasting. And sometimes I would write them down when I was wise. When I wasn't wise, I would just kind of like let that running narration happen in my head. But absolutely, when I eat something that I love, I try to very consciously taste it, not just eat it, but like really taste and think about what are the things that go into this. And not only what is the smell, what is the flavor, what are the ingredients, but how does it feel? Is it crunchy? Does it melt? Does it sort of dissolve in a weird way? Is there a lingering aftertaste to it? Is there something that changes in the flavor after you swallow? And I think all of that really served the book. I think I'm very conscious when I eat. And I think I'm also, interestingly, a very slow eater. I'll be the last person at the table. Everyone else will have finished. They're starting to clear the plates. And I'm like, no, I'm still eating. I think that's because I try to really enjoy everything and think about every bite. And I also try to eat things separately and together. So if there's some sort of dish that has multiple components, I'll try everything first and then I'll mix them and see kind of what is pleasing to my palate. So I think it's subconscious in a conscious way, if that makes sense.
And just to shower you with more compliments, I often find when you're reading descriptions of food and eating and cooking in fiction, there can be something slightly cringy about them, even if the rest of the prose is very good. And I very much didn't feel that with you. And I was interested to know, are there nonfiction food writers or recipe writers that you particularly enjoy reading or the style of or their recipes?
That's such a good question. I think there are a lot. I think I read sort of omnivorously in the food category. I'm not a huge nonfiction reader generally, but in food, I love food writing. So Ruth Reichel is one that I really appreciate and admire. Obviously, Nigella Lawson, I think, is brilliant. And I think not only in the recipes that she puts together, but in she's a way of describing things that are just so sensual. And
her
so
writing's lovely. Incredible.
And how do you not want to eat every single thing that she's talking about? Separately, quick plug for her Instagram. Every time I open one of those posts, I want to get on a plane and go to wherever she's just eaten the thing she's described and go and eat it. So I'm a very big fan of hers. I think Anthony Bourdain is a writer who was an absolute touchstone for this book, not only because of his love of food and descriptions of food, but also because I think he brings the humanity of what food means into every single bite that he's describing.
Oh, the heart.
The foods that he's eaten at somebody's kitchen table that happens to invite him over, who he barely knows, it's more evocative to me than a high-end restaurant description of, you know, a 12-course tasting menu.
So tell us, what is comfort food for you?
It's very wide-ranging. I love dessert. I've never met a dessert I didn't like. I love chocolate and all things sweet. I love pasta. If I could relegate myself to just one category of food, pasta would probably be it. I love really good, really fresh seafood, oysters and clams and shrimp and all sorts of things from the sea, I think are really brilliant. But I also think like really ripe, fresh fruit is something that I crave a lot and is really comforting to me, especially when it's ripe in a way that you can really rarely get unless you go to a farm and actually pluck something off of a tree. But like a ripe peach, when it's ripe to the point where the juice is kind of falling all over your mouth and hands as you eat, that to me is the pinnacle of just something luscious and perfect and delicious.
And tell us what we often call it a desert island meal, what your desert island meal would be. But by that, we don't mean you're going and spearing your own fish. I mean your non-bleak, unproblematic death row meal, your ultimate meal. Death row meal is probably not the right term to use with you anyway. Tell us about your ultimate meal, please.
So I think my ultimate meal is basically a secret family recipe, to the point where I still do not have access to this recipe. I much like my main character, can only recreate it from memory. So my dad started to experiment with this dish. I must have been, I don't know, 14 or 15 years old. So he's been making it now for about 20 years. And the first time he made it sticks in my mind as one of the best things I've ever eaten, bar none, hands down. In fact, I tried to put it in the book. There's a tiny little mention of it. And my dad was like, I can't believe you put that in the book. So it is a duck dish. It is this duck sort of ragu, but ragu is not even the right word for it. It is this really delicious duck stew where the duck is sort of fried first in flour and then it's taken out, but all of the drippings are used then to caramelize onions and these really delicious, sweet and tart dried fruits. So there's dried peaches in there. There's dried plums, which are really hard to get, but worth it if you can get them. There's dried apricots. There's dried dried cherries. And all of that becomes this delicious stew. The duck goes back in. It falls apart. And there is nothing that tastes better. There's cinnamon in there. There's a little bit of clove. It is just this perfect, sweet, rich, savory, tangy, fatty. It's a perfect blend. That would be my desert island dish.
You are allowed a pudding as well if you'd like.
Oh, that's a tough one. I love all dessert equally. I think the pudding would have to be more because of the memory surrounding the pudding than the actual pudding. But that's on brand. The night my husband proposed to me, he had planned this special secret meal on the Eiffel Tower in their lovely restaurant there. And we had, they called it a chocolate cog. So it was quite literally the size of a dinner plate. It was a large cog, the size of which holds together the Eiffel Tower. And it was made of chocolate and mousse. And it had this beautiful chocolate glaze on top. And we ate it and we were both very nervous. I think because I thought he might be planning to propose and he thought that I had no idea. And we both very nervously ate this beautiful, incredible, rich chocolate decadent dessert. And then we went out onto this balcony in the Eiffel Tower and he asked me to marry him. And so I think that would be the thing that I would want to eat forever.
Absolutely perfect. Daria, thank you so much for joining Table Talk. And Daria Lavelle's book, Aftertaste, is available now.